The book of Luke in chapter 16. I'd like to begin with you at verse 1. This is a scripture that is rarely taught on. Most people that I know say they have a hard time understanding it. So that means it's a good thing to teach. You know, if it's giving us trouble, then let's see what God's got to say. Now, Jesus is speaking, and automatically that makes it good. We can't go wrong tonight because we're hearing from the Lord Himself. Jesus said unto His disciples, "There was a certain rich man which had a steward, and the same was accused unto him that he had wasted his goods. And he called him and said unto him, How is it that I hear this of you? Give an account of your stewardship, for you may no longer be my steward. Then the steward said within himself, What shall I do? For my Lord has taken away from me the stewardship. I cannot dig, and to beg I am ashamed." Okay, he's been sitting behind the desk at a desk job for so long, he feels he's not physically fit, or either he's too proud, one or both, to go dig. He says he's ashamed to beg, but we'll see he's not too ashamed to embezzle, okay? All right, embezzle, yes. Dig, no, okay? I am resolved, he says, now, what am I going to do? Aha, eureka, I am resolved what to do, that when I am put out of the stewardship, the ones that I've been doing business with may receive me into their houses. So he called every one of his Lord's debtors unto him, and he said unto the first, How much do you owe my master? And he said unto him, About 800 to 900 gallons of oil. And he said, Take your bill and write quickly down that you owe 450 gallons. Okay? Then he called in another and said, How much do you owe? And he said, About 900 bushels of wheat. And he said unto him, Take the bill and write down that you owe only 800 bushels of wheat. And the Lord commended the unjust servant. Now observe that this word Lord here is in small letters. This is not God commending him. This is the guy he worked for. This is modern stuff now. Everybody ought to be able to follow this one. I mean, this didn't happen 2,000 years ago. And we read about this every day in the paper. Okay? And the Lord, the master, the guy that he worked for, commended the unjust steward because he had done shrewdly, wisely, for the children of this world are in their own generations wiser than the children of light. And I say unto you, and I say unto you, Jesus now says, make to yourselves friends of the mammon of unrighteousness, that when you fail, they may receive you into everlasting habitations. He that is faithful in that which is least is faithful also in much. He that is unjust in small things, he's unjust in big things. If, therefore, you have not been faithful in the unrighteous mammon, who will commit to your trust true riches? And if you have not been faithful in that which is another man's, who will give you that which is your own? No servant can serve two masters. Either he will hate one and love the other, or else he will hold to one and despise the other. You cannot serve God and money. Period. Okay? Now, let's go back up into the story and see what the Lord is saying to us. At first, this seems like a very confusing story, but really, it's not. It's really very simple. What we're really learning tonight, and what we're really talking about tonight, is your direction in life. What is your direction in life? What is my direction in life? You know, so many times in our directions in our life, we seem to put an undue amount of stress and emphasis on certain things in our life that God says shouldn't be there. One of the greatest things that we tend to put stress on in our lives are money. Now, the story is really very simple. Starts off very simple. We got a guy that works for a man. He's CPA. He's steward, you know. He's his accountant. Handles his money. And the boss finds out he's been dipping in the till. And he says, get the books in order and submit your resignation. He says, because I'm going to have to turn the books over to somebody else. You can no longer be the steward, be the overseer of my money. That's what the master in the story said. So we see then that he begins to scheme. And he says, my goodness, what in the world am I going to do? Here in verse 3. He says, I can't dig. I'm ashamed to beg. Ashamed to beg, but not ashamed to steal. So now he comes up with a, quote, bright idea in verse 4. He says, I know what to do. I've got an idea. I'm going to pull something off so that when I'm out of a job, the people that owe my master will feel obligated to me. I will put them in my obligation. Let me tell you something, beloved. Beware financial entanglements. People just love to try and make us feel obligated to them. Especially beware when someone is not your brother starts doing things to, in any way, financially or otherwise, obligate you to them. And so he brings in some of the debtors. And he says, how much do you owe? And this first guy says, man, I owe a bundle. I owe about almost 900 gallons of oil. He says, write yourself a bill out that you only owe half of that. Now, see, no matter what, once the master finds out about this, then he calls another guy in and he says, how much do you owe? And he tells him, man, I owe about 900 bushels of wheat. And he says, well, write down that you only owe about 800. Now, once the master finds this out, see, the guys that owe him, they've got a bill of sale that says they don't owe him as much as they really owed him. And it's obvious they're not honest. Or they'd have never done that in the first place. So the master of the business, he hadn't got a chance in court. I mean, his steward sure isn't going to say that he cheated. Right? The men that have already gone into a crooked deal with him, they're sure not going to say they entered into a crooked deal. And so it's his word against a written bill of sale, his steward and these men. The master, the owner of the business, knows he's been had again by this rat.
Now see, in this story, the debtors, they're also dishonest men. They're just like this guy. Boy, he knows his own kind real good. See, they're dishonest because they're going to go along with this deal. And then they're going to have to take him in later in order to keep him quiet, that they went along with this deal to cut down on what they really owed. See, they don't realize he's been fired. They don't know he's been fired, or else they might see the catch. This guy is going to obligate them to him forever in order to keep him quiet about what they've done. They have gone along with this dishonest deal too. This guy is smart, isn't he?
So this brings us, now you got the story in its simplicity. It's a simple story. But now comes those difficult little verses. Now let's see what they say and what they mean. All right, verse 8. Now this really destroys a lot of people. This verse. The master, the owner of the business, the Lord, with a little L, commended the unjust steward because he had done shrewdly. All right? He had done wisely. And the reason that Jesus says here is because the children of this world are in their generation wiser than the children of light, or to their generation. Now, what's actually being praised here? Obviously, listen, believe me, the guy that's just been swindled is not praising this guy for the fact that he's embezzled from him. He's not happy that he's lost money. He is merely making a statement of fact. It is a fact. This guy is shrewd. He saw that he had been had. He was about to lose his job, and he was planning ahead. He was looking ahead and carefully planning what to do in the future, how to take care of his future. And the master says, this guy is pretty shrewd. At least he's got sense enough to plan for his future. And then he says, the children of the world, in other words, the worldly people, in dealing with their contemporaries or dealing with their own kind, have more wisdom than Christians have in dealing with other Christians. And beloved, that is true. Hear me, Christians. What's he really saying to you and to me right now? He's saying, hey, fellas, this miserable fink in this story, this dirty rat, this swindler, he may be pretty dumb in some things, not realizing he's going to get caught up with by the Lord. But at least he's got enough common sense to know that he ought to plan ahead. Because things are coming to an end. But Christians walk up and down the street not thinking that things are coming to an end. And this guy was shrewd in dealing with the people of his own kind because, hey, dishonest people expect to be treated dishonestly. They know in the world system, hey, I remember when I was in the oil business. I knew everybody was trying to put it in me. I knew they were trying to steal from me. I knew they were trying to get the best of me in every deal. At least I was awake and aware because that was the game that we were all playing. But he says, the people that belong to the world system, at least they're shrewd enough to look to the future and look at, and they know how to deal with their own kind. He did. He knew how to deal with these men that owed his master. He knew them well enough that when he offered them larceny, they would accept it rather than turn him over to the police and arrest him. He knew the people that he worked with and lived with and dealt with. And he says, the ungodly know how to get along with their kind better than the children of God. Now, beloved, that is a terrible accusation, and yet the Lord is dead right. It's obvious that Christians don't get along with each other. We don't even make much of an effort most of the time to get along with each other. You know, the one thing that has really come to my mind and come to my life in the last year, and I hate to say this, but non-Christians are more honorable in their business dealings than most Christians that I do business with. Christians tell me they'll be there, and baby, they will not show up. I'm building a little study over my garage so I don't have to lease that office. Most of you know about that. Gave you a little testimony on that about 2 months ago. The Christian people that are working for me, and most all of them are, they never do what they say. I can rely on the fact that they will not be there when they tell me. Not on the day, probably not even the week. They just think, well, he's my brother and he'll understand. The heathens, their word means something to them. And they show up on time. What a disgrace to God. And we take advantage of each other in these intrapersonal relationships. But heathens know better. They know if they did like that to their friends, they'd get hauled into court and sued or something like that, you see. A good name is rather to be chosen than riches, silver, and gold. And so what's really being praised here is this guy's planning ahead. His planning ahead is being praised, not the fact that he embezzled. But at least this guy saw he had a problem and he started thinking about, hey, now Christians, it's wrapping up. Jesus is going to be here real soon. And we don't have very much more time. Are we planning ahead? Step one. Now let's pick up the next verse. And I say unto you, make to yourselves, Jesus says to us now, he's saying to the Christians now, and I say unto you, make to yourselves, friends. Now this word of the mammon, it's the Greek word ek, which means out of, or by. And probably a more modern rendition of that would, to help you understand it better, it would be better translated by. That one Greek word can mean any of those three words in English. Make to yourselves, friends, by the mammon of unrighteousness. Now what is this word, mammon of unrighteousness? You know, see, we don't talk King James anymore. That was 1611 English. That means worldly wealth. Things of the world. See, you're not going to need money in the next world. Money's something we use in this world. He says, now, I say to you, make yourselves friends by the worldly wealth, so that when it fails, what's this it that's failing? Your riches, your worldly wealth, when it fails, in other words, when you and I come to a place where that's no longer meaningful, in other words, beloved, when money becomes a thing of the past. All right? Make to yourselves friends by the money, by the worldly wealth, okay, so that when it fails, they may receive you into everlasting habitations. All right, now what's that say? Now, who's this they? Well, let me say that it may be two. Okay, you really got two choices on this one. This they that are going to receive to you are your friends. Now, this is not saying that you're, this is not teaching that you're bribing people to become your friends. Now, first of all, observe, in verse 8, he's telling us in our dealings with children of light, in other words, in our dealings with our brothers, that we should make friends of our brothers. See, it's one thing for you to be my brother, it's another thing for you to be my friend. You know, a lot of people, you know, think of your brothers in your own family, I mean, your blood kin. A lot of us don't like our brothers and sisters worth being. You know, now, and a lot of us don't like our Christian brothers. There's problems in there, and there's interpersonal problems. God says, hey, I want your brothers to like you. You know, it's one thing to love somebody, it's another thing to like them. I love people that I don't like to be around. I bet you do too. I mean, I got kin people that lie. I mean, every other thing they say is cussing and lying. I love them, but I really don't enjoy being around them. You know what I mean? Yeah, you know what I mean. So I figure I'm not the only one. So the point is, God says this. Hey, it's not enough that he's just your brother. He wants us to be friends as well as brothers. All right? That's important. So he says, make to yourself friends. Now, how can you tell that I love you? How can I tell you love me? How can you tell that bunch on that side loves you? And how can that bunch over there tell that you love them? How do we know we love each other? All right. John 3:16 is a very simple verse, but it's just loaded with dynamite. God so loved the world. How do I know that? That he did what? He gave. Now, that's how I know God loves. Yes, he gave his only begotten son. But the point is, he gave. Now, the way I can tell that people really don't love me very much is, and the way you can tell people don't love you much is, they don't give. They don't give up their time. They don't give, you know, you find out real quickly how close a family is when one of them starts down the tubes financially. Gosh, Charlie, I sure am sorry. Lord bless you. Keep you warm. Good luck. May the good Lord take a liking to you. See you next year. You know, by that time you're hoping, you know, you don't want to see him again because you feel guilty about, you know, he may try and put the bite on you. Now, how can I know, how can we all know whether there's love? Real love, see, phileo love, the love of man is selfish love. Phileo is related to selfishness and self-love. The highest love man can ever give is phileo love. And that always looks after number one. Even if I want to be a philanthropist and give money to the poor, I'm really doing it with a selfish motive. I want to beat the government for tax purposes, or I want to be praised for my philanthropic heart. You know, isn't it the truth? You know, and they bring me up in front of thousands of people because I gave this fantastic amount of money to this very needy purpose, you know, and they bring me up and they parade me out and I say, shucks. So really, without the Lord, phileo love, the highest love that man can generate, is always self-centered. There is a selfish motive. We give in order to get something out of it. To obligate. I'll give, but I want to obligate you. I figure I'm going to get it back by and by. With interest yet. Okay? It's like the Godfather in the movies. See, he'll do you a favor, but oh baby, are you going to have to pay back with interest? All right? Now, God's love, by agape love, just gives. Just gives. With no strings attached. They don't have to be worthy enough. We just give. And so God is in Jesus, is encouraging us. He says, look, just like this guy, this old fink, he knew how, in his own dirty little way, dealing with his own dirty little business partners, to at least plan ahead for the time when he would be in need. And he says, okay, fellas, what are you doing with your wealth? What are you doing with the provisions, whether it be money, doesn't matter, clothes, you name it, the provisions that God has given you and God has given me? God says, so that when it fails, when money no longer means anything, they will welcome you into everlasting habitations, into heaven. Now, who's this they? All right, it's number one, the possibility is it's your friends that you've helped, your Christian brothers that you helped, that you made friends out of. Possibility number B, and I say both are possible, who comes for you when you die? Well, look at verse 22. Now, that's on down there a little way, but verse 22 says, this is another story, but you got it. It's old Lazarus, the beggar, and the rich man. He says, we came fast when the beggar died. He was carried by the angels into Abraham's bosom. So it says, make of yourself friends of the with the mammon of unrighteousness, so that when it fails, they will welcome you. Who? They that come to get you. The A-N-G. The angels that come to get you and the people that you've helped. Charlie, there you are. Gosh, I'm glad to see you up here. Sure appreciate the time that I was really down and out and you came to my rescue. Can't wait to see what God's going to reward you with as a result of that. And so really it's a very simple story. See that God is teaching us in verse 9 that by the right use of our money, so that when money becomes a thing of the past, we won't have to walk around in heaven trying to hide from brothers and sisters that we wouldn't help. Can you imagine it? My gosh, there's Charlie. I let him lose his car. Let him lose his house. Now, someone says, Brother Floyd, is this communistic teaching? No, beloved, it's blood covenant teaching. You and I, those of us in this room that have been born again, have been carried into covenant by Jesus with each other. We're all covenant brothers and sisters. And in covenant, what one owns, all owns. Now, the difference between that and communism is Christianity, covenant teaching says, what's mine is yours. Communism says, what's yours is mine. Oh, that's different. See, communism says, what's yours is mine. You ain't got a choice. Covenant, Christianity is the opposite. See, you flip it. What's mine is yours because you're my brothers and sisters. Okay? Now, see, there's been so much bad teaching there in the book of Acts in chapter 2 and 4. When it says the early church held all things in common, people say, they practiced communism. No, they didn't. They practice Christianity. They said, and it doesn't, listen, in those stories, it doesn't indicate they sold the home they were living in and moved into a commune. It indicates that those that had more than they needed, sold and came and gave it and shared with the group. Okay? So really, verse 10 is a very simple verse, isn't it? It just teaches this. Fellas, are you going to pass it on? Or are you going to hold on to it with whited knuckles? That's it, isn't it? Are you going to hold on to it with whitey knuckles, or are you going to help your brothers and sisters out? Verse 11. If therefore you have not been faithful in worldly wealth, who will commit to your trust true riches? And if you have not been faithful in that which belongs to another, who will give your own? No servant can serve two masters. Hear me. That is an incredible statement. And I'm going to amplify on that one for a few minutes. Husbands, wives, parents. Your children cannot serve two masters. They will hate. If you do not stand united with your children in everything you do, your children will hate one of you and love the other. Listen. In God's wisdom, in marriage, two become one. And when the children at a young age, and boy, they'll try it, and they'll learn they can do it, if they can drive a wedge between you, they'll do it. And one of you, see, the devil's got us thinking that if we discipline our children, they won't love us. That's a lie from the pit of hell. Children can take a lot of discipline if there's a lot of love that goes with it. A lot of discipline without love will generate and breed a rebel. A lot of love without discipline is not the love of God. Love without discipline is not the love of God. It is not agape. It is phileo. It is selfish. You're trying to buy their love. God says in Hebrews chapter 12 that everyone he loves, he chastises. He spanks them. Or whatever discipline is necessary. If you really love your children, you'll discipline them. And if you really love the Lord and believe what God says, husbands and wives, you will stand together every time when you deal with your children. Now, if you really believe with all your heart your mate is wrong, keep your mouth shut while that child is there. Wait till the child leaves, or you and your husband, or you and your wife go alone in private, and share with them what your heart feels. And trust and pray together that the one that is wrong, that God will minister that to them, and that they will go and tell the child, I've changed my mind. I was wrong. It didn't make my children love me less. It built a relationship and deepened a friendship. Now, I want to say something about friendship, too. Children don't need 40 and 50-year-old buddies. Spock doesn't know what he's talking about. They need someone they can emulate. They need someone that they can want to be like. And since I want to be like Jesus, if that child sees me wanting to and trying to be like Jesus, letting Jesus be himself in me, then that's a worthwhile ambition for that child. How many of you realize that the call to be like Jesus is better than the call to be a prophet? You know, I mean, do you understand? You know, people are going, I'm a prophet. Let me just tell you that Jesus never, I can assure you, he never sat down and worried about his job titles. You know, whether he ministered today like a prophet or like a deliverer or, you know, like an evangelist or whatever, you know, everybody's worried about their job titles. If you are in business, any of you in this room tonight, if you're a Christian and you're in business, 50-50, 50-50, you have made a serious, grievous error. Now, you can do what you want to, but I'm going to tell you what God says to help you get out of that mess. Your employees will not like that. They cannot serve two masters. Someone's got to be the boss. It's true in your marriage. It's true at the church. It's true in every relationship. Someone has to have the final authority to say yes or no. In God's wisdom, whether we like it or not, doesn't matter whether we like this. God says the man is the head of the family. Hey, fellas, you don't have to go prove anything. God said it, that, you know, hallelujah. I don't have to go beat my wife over the head to prove it. You know, I don't have to demand my wife. God said it, so I can relax. And if she doesn't like that, she's got a problem with God. Someone has to make the final decision when the decision must be made. It's good if the husband and wife can talk it over and agree and really be one. But what if with all your hearts you can't agree? Then girls, God says, let him fall on his face. Hey, girls, it's real easy. If you really believe he's going to lose $10,000 if he takes the deal, and you give him your best counsel, and you pray, and he still wants to do it, let him do it. Next time, maybe he'll listen to you. You won't die. God will see to it that you won't die. God's promised you. You won't die. You won't starve to death. And the whole issue is, do you want to go to bed every night with your enemy or with a lover? Hallelujah. It's really easy. If you want to argue with him all day, you'll go to bed with an enemy. And if you want to go to bed with your friend, with your lover, with your husband, then give him your best counsel. And if he doesn't like it, let him fall on his face. He may have to fall on his face several times before he'll start listening to you. But I learned to begin to listen to the wisdom that God ministered to me through my help meet. One that was given to me to help meet my needs. Because when God made me, he said, woo, does he need help? Brothers and sisters, if you're in a business relationship 50-50, then you go to your partner and one of you become 51 and the other one 49. May I say this? If you would volunteer to be the one that was 49, one of two things would happen. Either he would then say, no, I'll give you the 51. Or he would take the 51 and God would bless you for it. Someone's got to be the head man. No one. Hey, I can't be wrong because God said it. See, this isn't my wisdom. I don't make up the rules. I'm reading. Jesus says it. No servant, no employee can serve two masters. Did you know every time in the Bible, if you want to understand the Bible, that every time it says servant, write the word employee. And every time it says master, write employer. And those are eternal truths that are still true all through the New Testament. If you are an employer and you want to know how to treat your employees, you get your concordance out and look up every time it talks about masters and servants. And God will tell you exactly how to treat your employees. And employees, God will teach you exactly how to work for your employer. Someone has to make the last decision. They will hate one of you and love the other. Verse 13, the last few words, you cannot. You cannot. That's it. You cannot serve God and mammon. Now, mammon, or riches, that word is even more important than the word riches. It's more full than that. It really carries with it the idea, anything that you trust or rely on. You cannot serve God, really serve God, and rely, depend on anything else. Because dependence is actually an act of worship. What do you depend on? Hey, all of us, come on. What do you depend on? Well, I belong to the union, so I know if I lose my job, they'll take care of me. Then you're worshiping the labor union. What do you depend on? Well, I know that I've got lots of insurance. You're worshiping your insurance policies. Wives, what are you depending on? My husband, good health, and boy, he can earn a good living. You're depending on your husband. You're worshiping your husband. Just made an idol out of him. Watch out. God may take him home. He'll show you that idol's no good. Beloved, what we depend on, dependence is an act of worship. I know a lot of evangelists that have always tried to hook themselves onto a sugar daddy, a guy with a lot of money that will sponsor their ministry. I'm so glad God's never given me a sugar daddy. Let me tell you about sugar daddies. When they start forking out all the money, if they're not really right with God, really right with God, and the relationship isn't really right, and most of those aren't, they'll start telling you what to teach. They'll start telling you what to preach. And if you listen to them, there's coming a time that you're going to stand before the Lord, and that worldly wealth won't help. You cannot serve God. You cannot really serve God and rely, depend upon anything except God. Now, it is true that the Lord may use people to minister to your needs. I know that's true because Luke chapter 6, verse 38 says, talks about give, and it shall be given unto you, good measure, pressed down, shaken together, and running over shall men give unto your bosom. It didn't say Christian brothers. It just said men. In other words, God will give you favor with people as you give, and God will give you favor in men's eyes, whether it be Christian men or not. So there's principles in the Bible that God uses, and God may use anything to bless you with. But the whole point is, who did you depend on? Now, when Casey went to the hospital, we prayed for Casey. God didn't heal him. Listen, you know, Casey's seen many people been miraculously healed. Casey's been healed many times. God didn't do it this time. Mike didn't get healed this time. But we've seen, in this room, most of us in here have seen many times God do supernatural miracles. This time he didn't. Now, question. See, most medical doctors are basking in the glory of God. It's an abomination to God. That means it makes God want to puke. They come out of the room Look at those hands. Why mind? Your husband was at death's door, but I delivered him. Now, question. Is that how we regard medical doctors? Now, in the past, that's how I did. And I think at some time in many of our lives, basically, you know, oh, doctor, can you save him? That is an unholy reliance and dependence. Now, it's true that, see, Casey didn't depend on the doctors. Casey believed that God, might believe that God was going to minister to them through these men. But their dependence, hey, you can give the best medicine in the world. And if God doesn't bless it, it ain't going to get you anything anyway. You know, the best doctors in the world won't pull you out if God doesn't. Healing, all healing is ultimately from God. Chemicals don't heal, believe me. Now, so what I'm showing you is there's an attitude, there's a frame of mind. Are we depending on God to minister to our needs, or are we looking for sugar daddies? You cannot serve God and mammon. You work for Dow Chemical? Yes. Does Dow Chemical pay your salary? Yes. Are you depending on Dow Chemical? Well, if you are, then you're an idol worshiper. But if you believe God gave you the job with Dow Chemical, I mean, Dow Chemical, they can lay you off any day. If you're depending on them, baby, you're in real trouble. I know about big companies. I used to work for them. The question is, how do you regard your relationship and your entanglement? Do you believe that you prayed that God would give you a job and Dow Chemical called you and you go over and they give you a job? Great, then you're depending on God. And if you believe if you lost that job, God just give you another one. But if you're depending on Dow Chemical, then boy, you're going to listen. Then all of a sudden, your dependence is on God. Now, some trust in chariots. And some trust in horses. But we will remember the name of the Lord our God. Now, let's see. What's America depending on? Is America depending on God? I think not. We are depending on nuclear weapons and a mighty army. We are idolaters as a nation. Beloved, if this nation would repent and come to God, the nation, the people, and come to God, we would not need nuclear weapons or anything else. And if the Russians started coming over here, we could all fall on our faces and say, "Dear God, you gave us this country. They're coming. The fight is yours. Do something." And God would do one of two things. The way God usually did that in the Bible is he told everybody, he says, "Okay, you really believe I'm going to come to your rescue?" "Yes." "All right, I want you to all go down to the beachhead right where the Russian army is going to land and just stand there." God almost always made them do something to show that they believed God was going to do it. So we just go down there with no weapons. Hey, you remember Deborah and Barak? Here's this enormous army coming at them with steel chariots. And there's 10,000 men with not a weapon in the whole bunch. Nobody had a weapon. And God told Barak, "Lead your army, forward march right into the teeth of those steel chariots." Deborah told him, he says, "Yeah, well, if you really think that came from God, how's about you walking at the front of this battle with me? I don't blame you. You know, some woman come up to me and tell me, the Lord told me to tell you to lead an army of 10,000 unarmed men against an army of about 150,000 men with steel chariots." Say, "Yeah, well, how's about you walking in the front with me?" You know, I mean, if you really believe that came from God, let's see how much you believe it. I don't blame him. I think I'd ask her that too. I mean, if God had spoken to me, great. If someone else come up to me, I had people tell me, you know, go to California. God told me to tell you to go to California. Great, God tells me to go to California. When God confirms that, I'll go. Now, God could have confirmed it to Barak in his spirit. And I think he did. I think he did because a woman did get credit for the victory that day. The little girl that drove the tent peg through old Sisera's head. But my point, when we all went down to the coast and the big Russian army landed, that's when California would cut right in half and they'd drop into the sea. See, I mean, God would defend this nation. We wouldn't have, you know, we just stand there and look good. He told Joshua, "Go down there to foot of hill and just stand there and make a good pose and look good." And God fought. 2 Chronicles chapter 20. Here comes this huge army against Jehoshaphat. God told Jehoshaphat, "Now you leave Jerusalem with your army tomorrow." Leave Jerusalem? Now, Lord, you made a mistake. Jerusalem has a wall around it. What you really mean, God, is for us to hide behind this wall, and then you'll whip them. No. No, if you really believe that I'm going to fight for you, you walk out from behind this wall. And as God told him in 2 Chronicles 20, go out there and strike a fancy pose. Put your shield up, draw your spear back, and just look good, and just stand there. And they did. And God wiped out the enemy army. Now, I don't believe those are pretty stories of history. I believe God's people can call on God for that sort of thing anytime. Now, I don't know about you, but I've been in a lot of spiritual warfare. And when I go into spiritual warfare, I know I can't whip them. I know I can't whip the devil. I can't defeat demons by my own strength. I don't have to. I just stand there and look good. It's the name of Jesus that does it. Jesus does the fighting. Man, I don't. I'd lose every time. Even though Satan's been stomped in the dirt, he's still stronger than me if I try and whip him by myself. If I just stand there and look good and draw the sword of the Spirit, the Word of God, put on the shield of faith, man, it's not even a fair fight. The guy hadn't got a chance. The question is, though, who are you depending on? See, don't you understand what I'm trying to tell you? We have been brainwashed in the American system by fear. And fear is not of God. Oh, I better, you know, what if I get sick? What if I can't pay for my operation? Just fear, 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 fear. I'd better belong to the labor union. What if I don't belong? What if I lose my job? What if? Man, that is not trusting God one day at a time. The entire television set is full of nothing but fear propaganda. What if we all get cancer? You know, check yourself every morning to see if you've got it. let me just tell you something. When I was in the oil business, I finally got to a level in the oil business where every year I had to go in for these great big examinations where they turned me upside down and made me drink this stuff and that stuff, and they put lights here and light there. I went through one of those things, and I went to them after that, and I said, let me tell you what, I'm not curious. I was feeling great till I went through that. And that is my personal opinion, that doctors fooling with all those little parts of my body are not going to help them and do them any good. And that if anything, look, God put them way up in those little places so people couldn't get to them.